Welcome to The Informed Gardener with your host, Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, Associate Professor and Extension Urban Horticulturalist at Washington State University. And now, the science behind gardening with Dr. Linda.
Hi, and welcome back. I'm Linda Chalker Scott, and that long-winded title you just heard simply means I'm your garden science translator. What I do is I go through the newest information in plant and soil science, and I translate it so you can actually use it in your garden. So every week, I stretch your mind a little bit, maybe take you out of your comfort zone, show you how you can use this plant and soil science to save time, money, and natural resources. Everything I share with you is based on good, solid, peer-reviewed science. And every week, I try to follow some kind of theme. Today's theme is better red than dead. We'll also head outside to chat with Cass Turnbull, the founder of Plant Amnesty, to find out what, or who, she thinks trees need to be protected from. But first, let's look at why it's better to be red than dead in the news. My first news tidbit is from the Weird Science section of the UK Sunday Mercury. On this blog, I read a neat article about floral landing strips. And this is from a New Zealand study on what bumblebees look for in snapdragons. Now, as an aside, I have to tell you that snapdragons, I think, were the first flower I ever planted. I had a little packet of snapdragon seeds my mother had given me, and I planted them. I must have been about 8 years old, and I watched them and tended them. And the most fun I had, of course, was opening their little mouths with my fingers, open and closed, open and closed. And that's actually pretty important in this story. Anyway, this particular research was carried out by students, which I always really enjoy when faculty involve their students in research. They did several summers worth of study, and they watched to see which color of snapdragons that the bumblebees would land on. And what they found out is that bumblebees look for striped flowers. So they had some white flowers, they had pink flowers, they had red flowers, and they had some that were striped. And the ones the bumblebees liked the most were the ones that were white and pink striped. They also happen to like the red flowers quite a bit. What the researchers did when they looked at this information to try to find out why bumblebees like the striped flowers is they noticed that the stripes always run along the veins. So in other words, they run from the outside towards the inside. And this actually helps in pollination. The pattern you see is kind of like a runway or landing lights on a runway where the bees will see this stripe pattern. It takes them from the outside of the petal right to the center where you've got that nectar and pollen that they're looking for. So this striping is a visual guide for these pollinators. Now what's really interesting about this particular article, and actually is not included in the article, is that bees really don't see the color red very well. But they do see into the ultraviolet range, and it turns out that the pigments that make flowers pink and red also absorb UV light. So even though they can't see red, they do see the UV reflection that these red and pink pigments give. And then with that white stripe down the middle, it's just like a little landing strip with those pink and red highlights on the sides. It turns out also that bumblebees are very important pollinators for snapdragons because they're very heavy and they're about one of the only insects that can actually open those flowers. So remember I was telling you about me sitting there and playing with my snapdragons and opening and closing their little mouths? That's what the bees do. They land on that bottom petal, that lip, and then their weight opens up the middle of the flower where they can crawl in and get to the pollen and nectar. So anyway, when you're choosing your flowers for next year's garden, remember that stripes are always in where bumblebees are concerned. My second news item is from ScienceDaily.com, and this one is entitled Flower Power Puts a Hurt on Caterpillars. This study was performed in Illinois by USDA scientists looking at the pest-fighting potentials of various types of plant pigments, and specifically these pigments are the ones that give blueberries and plums and grapes and blue and purple flowers their blue and purple colors. So what they did is they captured a bunch of corn earworm caterpillars, which, as you can probably tell by their name, are pests on corn and probably many other plants as well, and they forced them to eat only certain colors of flower petals. Now, the way you do this, of course, is that you put them into a container where they only have one choice, and they either starve or they eat it. And so what they did is they put some of the caterpillars in containers that had petunia petals, and some of the petunia petals were white and some were blue. And since they only had a choice of one or the other, they either had to eat that or starve. And what they discovered was that the caterpillars that were forced to only eat blue petals gained less weight than the caterpillars that ate the white petals. So they thought this was rather interesting, that something was in that blue petal flower that caused the caterpillars not to be as robust as the ones that were just eating the white petals. So they isolated the pigments from these petals and they tried those separately. So they just force fed the caterpillars pigments. And I don't even know how you force feed a caterpillar pigments. I can't imagine little tiny bottles of blue pigment. I just don't know. But it's a nice visual. And they discovered that, yes, this blue color also slowed the caterpillar's growth rate. So it definitely was the blue pigment. Then they tested another pest insect. And this one happens to be the cabbage looper caterpillar. Obviously something that bothers cabbage leaves. And what they found out with these guys is they put them on the blue petals and the cabbage looper caterpillars died at higher rates than the ones that ate the white areas. So not only did they not gain weight, they actually died. So this was really quite exciting because it's a great natural way to control pest insects. And the scientists aren't quite sure exactly what it is that's in the petals that causes that death rate to be higher, but they do know that it's definitely associated with that blue pigment, or it's enhanced by its presence. That's what they're still studying. The neat thing about this study is you can take those plant pigments and then use them as part of a breeding program, so you could create some new crop varieties that would have natural ways of repelling pests and, incidentally, also be more healthful for you. Because it turns out these pigments are powerful antioxidants, which is why blueberries and blackberries and grapes and other types of blue and purple fruits are such a healthy part of your diet, unless you're a caterpillar. So if you've been listening carefully to that last segment, you may wonder what blue and purple pigments have to do with being red. Well, we're going to have to solve that mystery a little later in the podcast. Are we at war with our trees? That's one of the questions I had for Cass Turnbull, the founder of Plant Amnesty. Here's what Cass had to say.
Probably from the tree's point of view, they'd say yes. People seem to be out to hack them in half and strip them out and head them back, all of which is damaging to trees. And if you were to be able to hear them, and I'm not saying you do, because that would make me a nut, they would be screaming and or complaining vociferously.
What would they be complaining about the most? What's the number one most egregious pruning?
Oh, that would be tree topping. There's a lot of crimes of neglect, like failing to water and maybe backing your truck into your tree by mistake. But the worst is when you actually pay somebody to vandalize your tree, by which I mean people climb up and cut the tops off. It just drives people who know better nuts, because you're actually spending good money to devalue your tree, make it ugly, and set it up to become dangerous in the future.
So that's the first thing people would say. Well, how can topping it make it dangerous?
Oh, well, it's a starting point for a lot of hazard trees, as they're called. The topping cut causes the trunk to rot out, so you get a great big hollow trunk, which is not strong. But also the new shoots that come back and eventually turn into limbs are very weakly attached. So a lot of trees that fell apart in the inaugural day storm were trees that had been topped in the Columbus Day storm. And those new tops that grow up and look strong were actually very weak, and when the wind hit them, they fell out. It's kind of the insanity of topping, is that it doesn't do any of the things people are hoping. It doesn't make your tree safe. It doesn't improve your view. It actually ruins the view by getting very bushy, and also, you know, people see a butchered tree with water in the background. And it doesn't even really make the tree smaller, because it speeds up its growth rate in response. So you get just as big a tree in, say, 5 years, except now it's really bushy and unattractive.
So is all this angst about this malpruning that got you to start Plant Amnesty?
Uh-huh.
And when did you first put pen to paper and say, we're going to have this group called Plant Amnesty?
Well, I'd like to say one day I just snapped. But I was actually doing a homework exercise, and somebody, in one of those sort of self-improvement kicks popular in the 80s, And they suggested that you write down all your complaints, which took me, of course, a couple of days and many sheets of paper, and then to pick one and write the solution. And being a professional gardener, I just picked, I hate bad pruning. And I realized, you know, you couldn't do it yourself. You'd have to have an organization. And the name Plant Amnesty made me laugh. Because
humor is important in these things.
Yeah, yes, it is. Because when people find out you're running a plants rights group, they're pretty sure you've lost your mind.
Yes, I guess they would be. I run across that a lot, where people will think it's just a plant.
Uh-huh.
You know? It doesn't have feelings, which of course they don't, but you know, uh-huh. Why does it matter? It's just another design element in the landscape, right?
Well, I guess it's, and actually I've given this a fair amount of thought. It's just, why would you want to destroy something that you want or like? I mean, that's why Plant Amnesty says death before torture. If you don't like your tree, just take it out. But to devalue it and make it look bad and lock yourself into high maintenance, it just doesn't make any sense.
It's exactly opposite of what that overused word sustainable means.
Oh, yes. And I guess it just expending all that energy that's going to backfire. The other major form of malpruning is shearing shrubbery, which people think, you know, Plant Amnesty is again, we're again the sheared shrubbery, unless it's a hedge or a real topiary. And it's not just an aesthetic determination. A lot of people think we're just party poopers and we're laughing at people for having bad taste, which it turns out to be. But it also locks people in kind of a battle against their plants. It's eventually going to kill them, and it's going to cause you a whole bunch of work and fill up the landscapes with the water sprouts that you have to keep cutting off.
And you have a really interesting term for water sprouts when you talk to people about topping and stuff. What do you call those?
I call that the Hydra effect. after the snake that Hercules battled, mm-hmm. What happens is people cut back their plant in an ill-fated attempt to make it small. And instead, you get this upsurge of straight, ugly shoots called water sprouts. And then your next reaction is to cut all those in half. But every time you cut them, you don't reduce them. And you don't slow it down, you speed it up and you divide it. You get more and more and more. And Hydra was the snake that Hercules battled, or a serpent, and he cut off its head and two grew in its place, and then he cut those and then there were four. So people inadvertently declare war, as you called it, on their shrubs and their trees just one day when they went out to make it smaller. And they don't realize that they've signed the contract that is going to waste a lot of their time. And
pruning in perpetuity contract.
Yeah, yes, malpruning in perpetuity. So if you're pruning your landscape correctly, your job should get to be less and less every year. You should be, when I take over overgrown gardens, the most work is up front, and it should drop, this is weeding too, should drop by 50% over the course of the next year.
Well, and that would be everyone's mecca for gardening, I imagine, is less work and more time to enjoy.
That's right. So it's a lot like the difference between beating a dog and training a dog. You know, you don't want to work against them. You want to work with them. So you want to tame your landscape, but in a way that nourishes its health, that the plants are happy, for a nice emotional term, anthropomorphic term. And that's kind of the art of gardening.
Yeah.
Is you're kind of keeping nature as a pet, as opposed to a caged animal.
So, Cass, even though I've known you for a long time, and I know all about Plant Amnesty, as many do in Seattle, there's going to be a lot of people listening to this that have no clue. So, just for the newbie, what is Plant Amnesty?
Well, Plant Amnesty's stated mission is to end the senseless torture and mutilation of trees and shrubs caused by malpruning. It's a pruning organization. You know, everybody has to have an organization, and we picked pruning. And the problem we're trying to address is really probably 90% of what passes for pruning, both with homeowners and professionals, is really malpruning. It's the opposite of pruning. It's just cutting, and it's going to get people into trouble. So as part of our program, we raise awareness, and we don't just say prune properly because that's a real snoozer. We say it's a crime against nature, which kind of gets people's ears perked up a little bit. And we have a sense of humor and a mission. The Ugly Yard Photo Contest and the Hall of Shame and the Slideshow of Pruning Horrors. And actually, this podcast would be part of alerting the public to the fact that there's something wrong happening. But then we have classes and lectures and lessons on pruning and a book on pruning and a DVD on pruning. And we also have a referral service of people we know how to prune and don't just think they do. So arborists and gardeners that don't just prune, they're qualified to take care of your yard in what we call now sustainable ways.
Yes, and that's why I've always recommended that if people are in Seattle that they go to your website to look for people that are certified or competent to prune. And for people that aren't lucky enough to live where plant amnesty is, I always say go with an ISA certified arborist,
right?
Which both you and I are.
Yes, and all the arborists on the plant amnesty referral service are ISA certified arborists. And then beyond that, we have them sign an ethics statement, and we check to make sure that they have all the licenses and insurances they need, so people don't have that embarrassing, you know, you're supposed to ask for their little white card and check their insurance and all that kind of stuff. So this is a way we sort of do the work for them.
Well, that's really a great service.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that always bugs me, especially when I'm driving out to the beach in these remote areas where there's second growth or third growth, Douglas fir forests, right where the power lines are, everything's been hacked. just hacked, and it's the most horrible thing. And these, of course, are utility prunings, and it's not that all utility pruners are bad, but it's just horrendous what I see. And you work with homeowners a lot. Well, what about utility pruners?
Well, actually, Plant Amnesty is probably the utility arborist's best friend, because really the only people that have a valid reason for chopping a tree are the utilities. They legally have to keep trees at least 10 feet away from the power lines. And if that's a birch planted under a power line or a Doug fir, and they're not allowed to take it out, which the homeowners say, no, I won't let you, then it will be topped. And they know that it's bad. They know that it causes the tree to rot. They know it causes water sprouts. So sometimes they do some fairly severe pruning. That rabbit ears is kind of a V prune around the wires. And that's not a nice thing to do, but it's one of those problems that doesn't have any acceptable solutions. People won't let them take the tree out. You can't let the tree grow through the wires because our lights would be going out every other day if they allowed that. Plus, periodically, people, you know, kill themselves by touching wires. And the correct utility pruning also isn't very attractive and isn't a very nice thing to do to a tree. So Plant Amnesty does have an article that shows good utility line clearance pruning on our website. It's in the free literature section. So if you have concerns that, and I'm not saying there aren't bad utility line clearance pruners, and especially the farther away from the hub of the universe, being here in Ballard, the farther away you get, sometimes the more unenlightened it becomes, but it takes some exploration. You need to read up on it before you start talking to your utility guy about how you want your tree pruned.
Because there are certain regulations they have to meet that you can't negotiate, right?
Well, you know, my neighbor, I caught her planting three birches under our power line, and it was right at the mailbox, and I said, you can't do that. And she's a lovely woman who loves plants, and she really wanted those birches, and I said, but they'll get in the power lines. And she went into that state of denial that we all get into, that, you know, I won't be around here when they get in the wires. But somebody will. The trees certainly will.
The trees are there, that's right.
Yeah. So I actually moved her trees for her and put them in my traffic circle and gave her the tree that was in my traffic circle, the little tree that will never get too big. But I just couldn't, you know, so utility line guys don't put the trees under wires.
No, they just have to take care of the problems that the homeowners cause, right?
Yeah. So it's the same thing as people just really can't conceive of how big everything gets, and everything gets bigger than you think it's gonna. And there's really, aside from hedges and fruit trees and maybe roses, accommodating the growing size of your plant is really the best way to go. The art of renovation and pruning is actually refereeing between plants, and sometimes it's just best to take out half the things when it's all getting too big, rather than constantly fight the size.
You know, and that's one thing that I wanted to mention that I really like about Plant Amnesty too, because a lot of people have this problem is they start with a landscape where everything's been planted too densely, things grow, you have things that get shaded out, they're failing. And Plant Amnesty has a free service where if you have a plant that you really love but you can't use anymore, that you can have someone come out, dig it up, and take it away.
Right, the Adopt a Plant program.
And I've done that myself. Yeah. You know, when we moved to the house we have now, we had stuff that just didn't belong there.
Yeah.
And people came out, they were very careful, they dug it correctly, they cleaned it all up, and the plant had a new place to live.
Yes.
It was great.
Yeah, and it's free.
Yeah.
It can't be free.
That's right.
We've included some pictures of Cass's pruning picks and pans on the Garden Professors website, and that's gardenprofessors.com. Each week on this podcast, I really look forward to answering some of your garden questions based on the theme of the show. I often get questions about why leaves turn red, and more, how do I fix red leaves? So that's the myth. Are red leaves a bad thing, or is it better to be red than dead? So as you heard early in the news segment, there's something interesting going on with red and blue pigments and how they affect beneficial and pest insects. So we're going to look at those pigments, and it turns out that all of them, the red pigments, the blue ones, the purple ones that you find in leaves and stems, flowers, fruits, and roots, all of those are due to a group of pigments called anthocyanins. And all anthocyanin means literally is floral pigment, so it's kind of a catch-all phrase. They're all water-soluble, means that they dissolve in water, which is unusual. Most plant pigments are not water-soluble. And they're also pigments that are not involved in photosynthesis. So they're not related to chlorophyll or carotenoids or any of those things that help generate sugars. These are different, and you'll see them very clearly in a lot of different plants if you just take a minute to look around. If you look at plants with young leaves, you'll see that some of them are red, and they stay red until they mature, then they turn green. A really good example of this is Photinia, which is a commonly used shrub around here in Seattle. Then, of course, there's the plants whose leaves turn red in the fall. They're green in the summer, and before they fall off, they turn various colors of red and orange and yellow before they finally fall off. And then there are plants that have red leaves all their lives, and a lot of these are very desirable cultivars that we like to use in our gardens and landscapes. Red maples, other types of red-hued leaves are just a nice counterpoint to the mostly green foliage we have. So naturally, some plants are just red. More interesting to me, though, is the different environmental factors that can cause leaves to turn red. The one that people always seem to think that is affecting their plants is lack of phosphorus. And it turns out that, indeed, if you're growing a cornfield or some other kind of agricultural crop and you don't have enough phosphorus in the soil, you will end up with plants that have red leaves. But you know, most of us don't grow intensive agricultural crops in our landscapes. We're growing various types of flowers and trees and shrubs, and most of us don't have a lack of phosphorus. It also turns out the environment can cause plants to turn red, even if they're not normally red at some part of their life. One of the things that can cause this is phosphorus deficiency. And, you know, a lot of people automatically think that their red leaves are caused because they don't have enough phosphorus in their soil. So they'll add more and more phosphorus to try to take care of that problem. Well, it turns out that, sure, if you're growing a corn crop or some other kind of agricultural crop, you might have a phosphorus deficiency. And the only way you will ever know is to have a soil test done. But even with that, if you're not growing corn or some other agricultural crop, you probably don't have a phosphorus deficiency. And your leaves probably aren't red because of that. It's probably something else. It turns out that drought can cause red leaves, some other kinds of nutrient deficiencies or some nutrient toxicities, salt, heavy metals, cold temperature, low soil oxygen, all these things can cause your plant leaves to turn red, at least temporarily. So the question is, what do all these environmental factors have in common? Why would all these things cause leaves to turn red? Well, it turns out that all of these things either directly or indirectly affect the water content of leaves. Obviously, drought, that's an easy one to see, that if when it's droughty, you don't have enough water, too much evaporation, then you're going to have too little water in the leaves and they turn red. Well, all these other things also can affect the amount of water in leaves. Cold temperatures, there's an example. If you have freezing temperatures, the water in the leaves actually starts leaving the tissues and freezing outside the cells. And this is actually an area where I did my PhD research, and we're not going to go into the whole thing with how cellular, extracellular freezing works, because you really don't want to know. But in any case, this can cause what's called cold-induced drought. So leaves that are exposed to cold temperatures, they turn red too. All of these things will cause somehow the water to be less inside the leaves. And this is the interesting problem now, is no one is really sure exactly how this works. So a lot of these ideas are right now purely hypothetical and are currently being tested by various plant scientists. So let me tell you a little bit of how anthocyanins work inside plant leaves. I told you they're water soluble, so they're dissolved in the water. And what they do as something that's dissolved in the water is actually dilute the amount of water that's in the plant. Now that might sound kind of confusing, so you have to visualize this. Pretend you've got a beaker of water, and then you're going to dissolve some substance in it. It could be salt, could be sugar, could be anthocyanins, anything you like. But you know that the more of that substance you put in there, the less of that area is taken up by the water, because it's going to displace the water molecules. So if you keep on adding sugar to water, for example, eventually the water is going to run over the edge of that container because you've put more material in there and something's got to go. And in that case, it's going to be the water. So the same thing happens in plant tissues. The more anthocyanins you have in the leaf tissue, relatively speaking, the less water is there. And what this means is the plant can actually hang on to that water tighter. It's less likely to evaporate. So what's the advantage of having less water in leaves after I just said that that's what causes red leaves to happen? Well, as I mentioned, it helps the plant hang on to the water a little bit tighter. It's going to help evaporation slow down, and it also can work as antifreeze. So let's go back to the salt example. You know that if you add salt to water, that it's going to freeze at a lower temperature. And that's, again, because you've got stuff dissolved in that water. So if you have water inside the leaf tissue and you've got anthocyanins in there, they could also serve as antifreeze compounds, allowing the leaves to be more cold hardy. So there's all kinds of really neat things that anthocyanins could be doing in the leaf tissues. We just don't know all the details yet. They also, in addition to the things I just mentioned, can help transport sugars out of the leaves into the trunk during fall. That's when you see them changing from red to orange to yellow. They also protect tissues against solar radiation, so they're a natural kind of sunscreen. And as I mentioned before, they're natural antioxidants, not just in the plant tissues, but in you, if you happen to eat those plant tissues. So that's why being red, or blue or purple for that matter, is better than being dead. And that goes for you too. So eat those red, blue, and purple fruits and vegetables. This podcast is only one of the ways I provide science-based information for use in your own garden. For more, be sure to visit my webpage, theinformedgardener.com. That's my official WSU webpage, and it's full of free and great information. Second, I hope you'll join me and three of my colleagues at the Garden Professors blog, and you can find us at gardenprofessors.com. The four of us take turns every day posting on just about any gardening topic you can think of, and even some that you probably haven't thought of. You can add comments, you can add questions, we always respond to those, and it's really a fun give and take among all of us. And finally, I've also published some books that might be of interest to you. One of them is The Informed Gardener, I mentioned it earlier. There's a sequel to that called The Informed Gardener Blooms Again. And finally, there's a great big book called Sustainable Landscapes and Gardens. And for more information on those books, you can find them on sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. In any case, I hope you found this podcast and the others entertaining and useful. I welcome your comments and questions. You can reach me at lindacs@wsu.edu. I hope you've enjoyed this week's podcast, Science and All. Be sure to listen next time when our theme will be Waterworks.
You've been listening to The Informed Gardener. For more information on Linda's books, future podcasts, as well as other stories and articles she's written, please visit informedgardener.com, gardenprofessors.com, or sustainablelandscapesandgardens.com. Thank you to Large Media, executive producer and production direction, and the WSU faculty and staff. Happy gardening!